This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, here we go. Healthcare meets the Supreme Court from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 26th of March. Great as always to have you with us. Once Chief Justice Roberts called the healthcare case this morning, it all got pretty technical pretty fast. An hour and a half long discussion of an 1867 law called the Anti-Injunction Act and whether the justices can even decide the case right now. But we'll get to that in a minute. Our healthcare reporter Gregory Warner was in the Supreme Court chamber today for the arguments. Hey, Gregory.
Hey there, Kai.
So what was it like today, man? Center of the universe, right?
Yeah. If you want to find a circus, just look for the TV cameras, right?
That's right.
There was chanting, signage, one side singing Protect the Family, the other side singing Protect the Constitutionality, which rhymes. But look, I also overheard some fairly intimate conversations between ostensible opponents about medical needs. So it was fairly surreal on the steps of the Supreme Court.
Did we get, though, I mean, once you guys got inside through the metal detectors and into the chamber, do we have a sense of whether the Supreme Court is actually going to decide this thing? Because that was the nub of the case today, right? Whether they have grounds to decide.
Well, Kai, obviously we won't know for sure until the court announces its decision in June or early July. Folks who read the tea leaves on this stuff said that the court will hear the case. In fact, you could hear there was a lot of drawing the lines in the sand for tomorrow's question, which is, does Congress have the power to impose a fine on people who don't buy insurance? Here's Justice Kagan. She's talking to the Solicitor General, who's representing the government. Mm-hmm. And she asks if not paying that penalty means that that person has committed a federal crime. He says no.
And that's because...
that if they don't pay the tax... they violated a federal law.
But as long as they've paid the penalty.
If they've paid the tax, then they're in compliance with the law.
Why do you keep saying tax?
If they pay the tax penalty, they're
Thank
in compliance
you.
With the law.
There's Justice Breyer getting in his dig, but essentially implying, is Congress overstepping its reach with the law? That's going to be the question tomorrow.
Right. Why does it matter, though, Gregory, whether Congress decides this thing this year or waits until 2014, 2015? Because the thing's been sitting around for 2 years already. What's another year or two?
The big issue is uncertainty. Look, the Obama administration made a decision early on. It was a political decision when they decided that this health care law, the major provisions, would not kick in until 2014. Now, that was good economically because it meant the law would be less of a bite on the deficit because it comes later and that's how accounting is done. But that's meant this 4-year drag-out fight. And uncertainty is taking a huge toll from hospitals to HR departments and companies. Businesses are waiting to make these crucial business decisions about health care. I was talking to Zeke Emanuel. He's a bioethicist at the Hastings Center. He was watching the hearings. He talks about that uncertainty.
Hospitals and doctors who are trying to redesign their care systems to cut costs and deliver better quality of care. Well, maybe the law won't be the law. Maybe the rules are going to change. And so they've been holding back a little bit. Insurance companies the same way.
So that's why businesses care. Get rid of that uncertainty. That's the question before the Supreme Court.
Right. All right. So let's talk about tomorrow. The heart, a lot of people say, of the case, the individual mandate and whether the government can force us to buy health insurance. What are we looking for?
Well, look, this is something both sides agree on. Health insurance only works if you have healthy people in the pool as well as sick people. Happens every day in companies, big companies, where one worker will be healthy, another worker is sick, both pay the premiums, and that pot of money basically pays for everybody's health care. Now, the problem is that doesn't at all work in the individual market when people are alone. They don't have a pool of people. So the government's going to argue, hey, we need to be able to tell people they have to buy insurance in order this health market can work. The state's saying no, because if the government can force people to buy something, even health insurance, they can force us to buy anything, even broccoli.
Broccoli is where we'll pick it up tomorrow. Gregory Warner will make it all make sense for us. He was in the chambers today. He'll be there tomorrow as well. Gregory, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Elsewhere in the American economy today, the verdict was clear. Buy, baby, buy on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke crossed the Potomac River into Arlington, Virginia today for a speech. The National Association for Business Economics, a fairly influential crowd. And as happens pretty much every time he opens his mouth, Mr. Bernanke made news, to wit, that the Fed will keep on keeping interest rates low until the economy is growing again, growing strongly, to be precise. We're going to know that's happening, he said, when we see a lot more job growth than we're getting now. As usual, though, the Fed chairman didn't come right out and say that. There was jargon about continued accommodative policies involved. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to translate.
The Fed has kept short-term interest rates near zero to get the economy to grow faster. Cheap money makes it easier to buy houses and cars and factory equipment. And the policy seems to be working. Unemployment's down to 8.3%. That makes some investors think the Fed won't keep interest rates low through the end of 2014 as promised. So the first thing Bernanke had to say was this.
The better jobs numbers seem somewhat out of sync with the overall pace of economic expansion.
Economist Nigel Galt at IHS Global Insight says that means Bernanke doesn't think companies are hiring because they're in a great mood. Instead, they got spooked back in the recession and laid too many people off.
So maybe it's catch-up hiring by companies, and maybe it isn't indicating that the trend growth of the economy is about to take off.
Bernanke worries that job creation could still slow down.
Further significant improvements in the unemployment rate will likely require a more rapid expansion of production and demand from consumers and businesses, a process that can be supported by continued accommodative policies.
Continued accommodative policies. That means Bernanke thinks the Fed has to keep interest rates low and pump more money into the economy until at least the end of 2014. One final word from Bernanke, don't worry too much about inflation. There's no sign employers have to pay higher wages to attract workers. That's a message we don't need a Fed-speak translator for. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you owe money on a student loan, and odds are you do, because there is about $1 trillion worth of student loan debt out there, here's my question. Are you up to date on your payments? Because if you're not, you're in for some very nasty phone calls from debt collectors working for the Department of Education. John Hechinger writes about federal student loans gone bad and what the government's doing to get some of its money back for Bloomberg News today. John, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Who are these, or what, I suppose, are these debt collection companies? Private enterprises, right?
They are. The Department of Education hires a kind of army of debt collectors that work on commission. The more money they collect from borrowers, the more money they make, the more money they take home.
And is it fair to say that that sort of influences their tactics?
Well, I think it is. They have a strong incentive to collect as much money as they can up front, and they have very little incentive, the way the contracts are structured, to let students into some very favorable plans that the Obama administration and Congress has been trying to promote.
What are their powers, though? I mean, what can they force these debtors to do?
Well, debt collectors have powers that are for student loans that are unlike any other. They can garnish wages without a court order. They can take Social Security checks. There are no statutes of limitations. So they really have borrowers over a barrel. Elizabeth Warren, who is a Harvard law professor and bankruptcy expert, once said that...
And also, we should say, candidate for the Senate in Massachusetts.
That's true. Yeah. She once said, student loan debt collectors have power that would make a mobster envious.
Oh, man. Define your terms here for me for a second, John. How much money is out there in defaulted federally guaranteed student loans that we're talking about?
It's about $67 billion, and it's doubled since 2003. And you have to remember that student loan debt outstanding is enormous. There's $1 trillion in student loans outstanding. That's more than credit card debt. And there's a lot of pain out there. A lot of people are having trouble paying it back in this economy.
So what actually happens? I mean, give me an example. You talk to a bunch of people for this story.
The borrower defaults on his or her loan. The borrower gets a call from a debt collector. And the debt collector says, you've run out of options. You must pay a minimum, maybe $200, $300 a month. And the borrowers I talked to were in some pretty desperate straits. They were disabled. They didn't have the money. Many of them said they wanted to pay something, but they couldn't pay $200, $300 a month. And what they were told is, I'm sorry, this is the minimum. This is all that we can do. And that's not the way the program is set up. The program is set up where the debt collectors are supposed to work with borrowers. They're supposed to find out what their incomes are and find out what they can afford to pay. The Obama administration and Congress have said they want to have these income-based payment options. And at least what I'm told is that borrowers often aren't informed about their rights.
You know, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren earlier, the woman who was the brains, I think you could say, behind the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The CFPB has tried to regulate these guys, hasn't it? Debt collection agencies.
That's right. They're proposing to regulate. They're very interested in this subject broadly, not just for student loan debt collections. Mm-hmm. And they're very aware that the Federal Trade Commission receives more complaints about debt collection companies than any other industry. Hmm. So one way or another, these companies are under a microscope.
John Hechinger, he's a reporter with Bloomberg News. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Turns out this is going to be a big year for the movie industry. Hunger Games aside, it's not necessarily going to be a year of record ticket sales or blockbuster franchises. No, according to the research firm IHS Screen Digest, later this year, movie streaming over the internet is expected to overtake traditional home viewing of movies on DVDs and Blu-rays. And that means consumers could wind up spending far less on the movies that we watch. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
On the surface, it sounds like blockbuster news for the entertainment industry. The report predicts the number of movies rented or purchased online will jump by 135% this year. But consumers are expected to spend $11 billion buying DVDs and Blu-ray discs this year. Compare that to less than $2 billion they'll spend on movies over the internet. As CNET senior writer Greg Sandoval sees it, this could be one of those scenes with a train barreling straight down the tracks toward Hollywood.
Be good news for the studios and creators, because if it happens quicker than they think, they're unprepared. They haven't figured out how to make money off of streaming yet.
Sandoval explains that all-you-can-eat style subscription services are eating up much of the revenue.
When you stream, they're paying much less money for their video than if they were buying.
Sandoval says the industry has looked at streaming as something in the future, but the future is now. Shelley Palmer is the author of Overcoming the Digital Divide. He says the studios need to relearn an important lesson.
They were completely convinced that VHS tapes would put them out of business. Then they were completely sure that DVDs would put them out of business. And in both cases, both technologies enhanced sales dramatically.
Palmer says the key is embracing what consumers want.
As long as the movie studios fight the good fight, by making it super easy to stream legally, by making the price appropriate for a legal stream, they're going to have a good line of defense.
You could say they need a strategy right out of the movies.
I'm going to make them an offer he can't refuse.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Coming up,
For every job that a robot takes over from a human, there are other human jobs created.
Our new series, Robots Ate My Job. But first, let's do the numbers. Not a bad way to start the week, if you ask me. The Dow Industrials rose 1.2%, 160 points, topped out at 13,241. The NASDAQ climbed 1.75%, 54 points, 3,122. The number you're looking for, the S&P 500 jumped 1.33%, 19 points, 1416 at the bell. Fed Chairman Bernanke said today the economy still needs help, as Mitchell was telling us, as in cheap money. And in response, Morgan Stanley kicked up more than 4% today. Healthcare stocks aren't waiting for the Supreme Court to celebrate. They gained the most of any group today. Five-star Quality Care picked up 6%. LCA Vision saw a 4% increase. LifePoint Hospitals advanced 3.33% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.25%, 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. How are we feeling about the economy? The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The House Natural Resources Committee holds a hearing on rising gasoline prices. And he wrote and directed Inglourious Basterds, among many other films. Quentin Tarantino will be 49. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hey, happy National Spinach Day, everybody. All right, it is, I grant you, one of the lesser-known food observances, especially compared to something like National Pancake Day, February 28th, National Pie Day, March 14th. We missed that one. So it can be hard to keep track, as you can see. But I'm here to offer two words that can help you out with that. Free and stuff. Sendhil Malanathan teaches behavioral economics at Harvard University, and thankfully for us, he's here to explain what this is all about. Hey, Sendhil.
Hey, Kai. How are you doing?
I'm all right, man. What's going on?
What'd you do last month for National Bagel Day?
What?
We just had National Bagel Day.
I didn't know there was a
bagel day.
I have salmon in the fridge and everything. Nobody told me.
Well, if you had known, you could have gone to Brugger's and gotten a free bagel. That's what they did for their celebration this year.
Okay, but why?
I think what they're doing is they're relying on one of the oldest principles in psychology called reciprocity.
Okay.
There's a beautiful psychology experiment that goes back 40 years that shows this. In this experiment, there's a subject, he's working away, and halfway through the experiment, somebody had gone out for a Coke. They come back and say, hey, I also brought you a Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And the real experiment is at the end of the study, the person says, hey, do you want to buy some raffle tickets? And what they found was that
it's like a bait and switch, man.
It's a little bit like a bait and switch. If they had brought back a Coke for you, which cost 10 cents, people were much more likely to buy raffle tickets. In fact, they bought 50 cents more worth of raffle tickets just because this guy spontaneously gave them a gift of a Coke. As a result, they ended up selling two more raffle tickets, which earned them 50 cents. That's a 500% rate of return, and that's why reciprocity is so powerful.
Right, which is a good deal. So give me the, is it a little bit, I don't know, is it like holding doors open for people? Is it, what's the real life example?
Holding doors open. I often think about Hare Krishnas at the airport. I don't know if you've seen these guys.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They give you flowers.
Right.
Well, they're giving you flowers for a reason, because once they give you a flower and you take it, now you're like, oh man, now I need to talk to these guys. And that feeling we have of having to give something back when someone's given something to us is really the power of reciprocity. And like in the Hare Krishna example, even if you didn't really want the flower, even if you really don't want to talk to the guy, you're sort of compelled to.
It's a little bit like being indebted, right? Is that kind of the deal?
Yeah, it is very much like being in debt. And in fact, there are cultures where this is so much treated like debt. Like in parts of China, they have elaborate books they keep where they say, these are the gifts I've received from these people in the village. And this is how much I've given back. And this is how much I'm in the red I am. And this is how much in the black I am with this guy. And there they've turned it into a whole accounting system. But in our mind, I think we keep these accounts. Oh, you helped me move last time, Kai. Now I got to help you move.
Yeah. No, I get that. But so bring it back to the bagels for me, because I totally get the moving thing, right? Because I've done my share of helping guys move out of their apartments and, you know, U-Haul trucks and all that stuff. And I've counted on them to do the same. But what happens with Brugger's bagels? They give me a bagel, and then the next time I've got the munchies, that's where I go?
Yeah, you feel like, or maybe even this time, you went in for the free bagel, but do you want to be the guy to just get the free bagel? All right, fine, I should buy something else while I'm here.
Right, so you buy the schmear and the cup of coffee and the...
Exactly, and you guys in public radio, I bet, use this all the time. Nonprofits use
this.
You're
giving it away, man. No, you can't tell our secrets.
So, you know, I get these solicitations from the charities, and they give free address labels with them.
Right.
And now I'm like, oh, they send me this address label. I should give some donation. And in fact, this isn't just a tactic. It's a very profitable tactic. There was a study that showed including these little gifts increases donations by 75%. And so you make the money back by giving this away.
All that for a bagel. Sendhil Manathan teaches behavioral economics at Harvard. Sendhil, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We're going to take some time this week, all week, actually, and spend it on technology and jobs. Arguably the two biggest factors in where our economy's going. We're going to call it Robots Eat My Job. Who's winning and who's losing as technology becomes an ever bigger part of our lives? It's not unreasonable to think here in late March of 2012 that you might be able to drive clear across the country and never interact with anybody. No humans, only machines. Marketplace's David Brancaccio is trying to do just that. He put the Atlantic Ocean and the great state of New Jersey behind him on Saturday.
I'm refueling in Sugar Hill, Tennessee. 2,229 miles to go to the Golden Gate Bridge. Technology only, avoiding human contact. Sleeping at Hyatt Place hotels that have the option of robot receptionists. Swipe myself in with my card and the key to the room comes out a slot. We're told that on balance, good and better jobs come from all the technology that makes a trip like this possible. But experts are warning this is now changing. In Pittsburgh the other day...
This guy here, who's this?
I ran into a robot that takes queries.
Here's a great question. Will robots take over the world?
Will robots take over the world? Yes, and the revolution is set for a week from Saturday. Okay, I'm kidding. It's this Thursday. Kidding again!
That's Andy Royd, the human-shaped, human-sized centerpiece at the Carnegie Science Center's RoboWorld, the biggest robot exhibit on the planet.
And for every job that a robot takes over from a human, there are other human jobs created.
Wow. It may be Andy's program to say that because we've been worried about technology taking our jobs since the first time someone threw a wooden shoe at a weaving machine. Legendary economist John Maynard Keynes worried about what he called technological unemployment. And pop culture adores the subject.
Do you know what he's doing here?
What?
He's trying to replace us all with a mechanical brain.
In the 1957 movie The Desk Set, the research department of a TV network gets stuck with one of those newfangled computers the size of a pipe organ. In the real world, no one denies that technology destroys loads of jobs. Look at what happened to farm work as machines hit the fields. But the data kept showing that our economy continued to grow, more often than not, as technology came online. 20 excruciatingly cute robots, think of them as orange mice the size of vacuum cleaners, scurry around the warehouse of Acumen Brands, an internet retailer out of Fayetteville, Arkansas. The electric critters deliver entire racks, 12 shelves tall, to people who stick the merchandise into boxes for shipment, things like medical garb or scrubshopper.com. The robots you interact with may not be as huggable as these, but they are everywhere.
Welcome. Please scan your first item.
Think about this. 5 years ago, did you use self-checkout at a retail store?
This is the man who runs the company.
When you went to Hertz to check in using a kiosk, did you do that 2 years ago?
That makes the robots we tend to see on a daily basis.
Thank you for using the NCR self-serve checkout.
William Newty is CEO of NCR, a company with more than 20,000 employees, including those with nice jobs at a new manufacturing plant in Georgia.
The people making all of this automation are better jobs, higher-paying jobs, and frankly, jobs that have a greater future.
Do you worry about the bank teller who doesn't have the job anymore, or do you worry about the checkout clerk who doesn't have the job anymore?
No, we actually enhance the opportunities for bank tellers or checkout clerks because they're being retrained in most businesses to move into higher-end customer services roles that, by the way, pay more and have a longer life. So when we come into the picture, the jobs change, but they get more valuable. They get more relevant to where the economy is going.
You're not just saying that because you know that there'll never be a CEO kiosk?
I hope not. I really genuinely hope not, but you never know.
But something's happening in 2012 that's sorely challenging the economy's ability to keep up. Engineers are getting very good at this technology stuff.
Just in the past few years, we see computers start to demonstrate skills that they have never, ever had before and that used to belong to people alone.
MIT professor Andrew McAfee studies technology's effect on business. He just did a book called Race Against the Machine with his fellow MITer, economist Eric Brynjolfsson. What's happening with technology now is bordering on magical, Brynjolfsson says. But this progress has a price.
The difficulty today is that the pace and scale of that change is happening so rapidly and so pervasively that we as a society and our entrepreneurs aren't thinking of new jobs and new industries fast enough to keep pace with the jobs that are being eliminated. And that's manifesting itself not just in higher unemployment, but it's also manifesting itself in a big change in wages and the fact that median incomes today are also lower than they were a decade ago.
The MIT guys argue that the march of technology is not benefiting regular people with typical jobs. McAfee says jobs at the bottom of the scale, like cleaning hotel rooms, seem immune from robots, and technology is bringing bounty to those toward the top, but...
And the middle of the job distribution, the middle class, if you want, seems to be getting hollowed out.
Globalization is part of this. So is the last recession. But there's now evidence that what's wrong with the labor market is not just the ebb of the business cycle, but has something to do with technology, an idea we'll keep exploring this week. Meanwhile, if robots are your business, jobs are up 44% this year. More on that boom tomorrow. On the road, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
There are robots all around nowadays, even if we can't see them. We've got some video on our website. It's marketplace.org. You're looking for robots. Eat my job.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All right, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gained 1.2%, 160 points. The NASDAQ climbed 1.75%, 54 points. The S&P 500 up 1.33%, 19 points. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Holm, Millie Jefferson, Fiona Ng, and Joel Patterson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tomorrow, same time, same channel. We'll see you then. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.